Welcome to Hearth and Soul. You're listening to episode 2. I'm your host, Angela Torres-Cuckun. I'm a foodie, a food nerd, opera singer, and the food manager and preservation queen at Spoken, a cafe in the Ravenswood neighborhood of Chicago. I have extensive experience in food service, and I think I have this passion that sits within me. And the more I learn, the more I want to share. And people started asking me questions, and the more questions I answered, the more I realized that maybe I should put it down for other people that maybe don't know me and can't ask me in person. I have an update from our last episode. We talked about produce a lot in episode 1, and we talked about imperfect produce specifically. And at the time, I had signed up for their services but had not yet received a box. And my update is I am now 3-4 weeks in, and I think it's awesome. I love that I can customize it. I love that it fits my budget. I love that I can pick organic or not organic. I will say, funny story, I signed up and somehow they had the wrong address and it got sent to my work at like 8 o'clock at night when I wasn't there. And they called me and I said, hey, yeah, I'm not at work. I don't know how you got that address, but this is my address. And is this a problem? And they said no. And they were super awesome. And they brought it over to my house, but they have to cancel an order in their system when they can't deliver it to its original address. So then the next day, I got a second box. So I have to admit there was a little bit of waste because I just couldn't eat it all in a week before I got my second box. But I love the idea. I love that they contribute to getting rid of food waste. I love that it's customizable. I love that you can get organic. I love that you can pick and choose different things that you maybe wouldn't buy in the grocery store every week. And I love that it comes to my house even when I'm not there. I think it's really fantastic.
In the vein of imperfect produce, since we're going to be talking a lot about citrus, I actually really like citrus that has like limes with brown spots or lemons where there are maybe softer spots on the rind. Mm-hmm. And that's because like at that point the fruit has relaxed, a lot of the sugars have been released, a lot of the acids and other elements within the fruit are at its peak. So if you were to juice that at home for home use, it's actually probably the most flavorful citrus juice you can get.
Oh, nice.
So if it's like, if you're at the grocery store and you see a lemon that doesn't look the most pretty.
Right.
And it's probably going to be...
It's probably better.
It's probably better for making glazes or juicing, mm-hmm, or mm-hmm, for marinating a chicken in, because there's going to be a lot more lemon flavor.
And fantastic. Just other elements. Yeah. That being said, this lovely baritone voice that you are listening to is my special guest for the day. He's going to be my co-pilot, if you will. This is Ian Hosak, and go ahead and introduce yourself. Tell us about yourself.
Well, you got my name.
Did I say it right?
It's Ian Hosak.
Ah, I knew I was going to screw it up. All right. I should have asked you before we started. But
so I'm Ian Hosak. I've been in Chicago now for going on 14 years. It's been a really long time. Yeah. Yeah. I grew up in this city. I became an adult in the city. Like you, I have a background in music. My studies are all in music. I tried like hell in music for over a decade. And in that time, I also began working a lot. I worked a lot. I had a lot of jobs, but I found home in liquor.
Awesome.
Weirdly enough, which is such a loaded statement to take to your grandma.
I'm in the liquor business, Grandma.
Well, what are you doing now? Liquor.
Liquor. A lot of liquor.
A lot. Yeah. Yeah. So I represent brands of liquor right now. I work for a company, Romano Beverage. We're new this year. Before Romano Beverage, I was doing representational work for Koval Distillery, which is a homegrown distillery here in Chicago. Did a lot for them, like a lot of different stuff for them. And
we use a lot of their stuff at Spoken. I use a lot of their stuff, I should say, in the jam making process. I'm a big fan of jams with liquor in it.
I'm a big fan of distillate. I think it's a really beautiful commodity, and I think it has a lot of potential beyond just what it is to be enjoyed. So that's a little bit about me. So right now I am working with Romano Beverage. I represent their spirits. I represent their wines. I am their mixologist on staff. And that's kind of my background.
You do make a good drink.
Thank you.
I can vouch for that. Yeah. So before we get into our actual subject, which is acid, and I don't mean the stuff that comes on the sheets. I'm not talking that kind of acid. we are talking about food after all. But I just want to touch on, so Ian and I got together the other night and had some drinks and talked about what we wanted to talk about on this podcast. And we both realized that we're super nerdy about this stuff. We're super passionate about food and beverage and its history and where it comes from. So it was interesting to think about how we're both classical singers, but this is what we're doing for a living. Do you want to say a little bit about why are we doing what we're doing? How did we get here?
I mean, I think a lot of singers or musicians, singers, I say singers because I'm literally in a room full of singers.
Right.
But I think a lot of these musicians in Chicago and in the Chicago musical community in general, I think we can all say, is filled with people doing musical work at a varied level of budget,
right?
We'll say, and how they can fill that in their life. And for me, I wasn't doing it in a way that really fulfilled my professional needs.
Mm-hmm.
And I am a person who is not just fulfilled creatively. I am a person who is fulfilled mentally, intellectually, and emotionally.
Mm-hmm.
It is a full holistic experience for me. I really needed a creative outlet, and I also need to be communicative. That's
right.
Why I chose the vocal arts when I was studying music, but mm-hmm. also why music is so appealing, because at the end of the day, if you're making music, you're telling a story.
Mm-hmm.
And I got into liquor actually because I didn't get into the grad school I wanted to go to.
Oh.
I got super drunk one night. Embarrassingly drunk. I was way too old.
How many stories start like that, though? Let's be honest.
I mean, this one was, I was way too old to be annoying. And I was certainly annoying. Because I was very drunk. I was blackout drunk. And I never condone getting blackout drunk.
Mm-hmm.
But in doing so, I woke up the next day. And I saw that I had ordered cocktail books, cocktail tools, liquor. I had bought a lot of liquor online, and I had emailed several distilleries in the Chicago and Chicagoland area asking for employment. And that's how I got my job at Koval.
Wow. So you were like super efficient while you were drunk. Is that what you're telling me?
I looked at those emails and I communicated very effectively.
That's amazing. That's brilliant.
I know. I'm not sure how. I was brief. I think that was my secret.
Uh-huh. Okay.
As a blackout drunk person.
Right.
Kept it simple. But yeah, so that's how I got into it. And creating drinks, making drinks, working with liquor, communicating about what liquor is, what spirits
mm-hmm,
are,
mm-hmm.
and the history behind spirits, which I delved a lot in with Koval, especially. Koval as a company and a brand really promotes an understanding of whiskey and gin as not only a commodity, but an art and a history.
Awesome.
So it gave me that communication. It gave me that ability to be creative with cocktails and, you know, really what my cocktail making is, because I don't have the experience some of my colleagues has. It's like, it's actually kind of something that gives me a lot of stress, is that mm-hmm. I walk into a room and everyone knows way more than I do.
Imposter syndrome.
Yeah. But for me, cocktailing is looking at these recipes, reading these old books, talking to these bartenders who've been doing it for years and kind of riffing, which mm-hmm. is a lot of what I did as an artist. It was
mm-hmm.
looking at somebody else's composition, looking at these pieces that had been done probably a million times over
mm-hmm.
by the time I even had to look at them, and reinterpreting them. So it fulfills a similar creative need.
No, I get that. I get that because I like what you said about stories, because at the end of the day, when we're on stage, what we're trying to do is tell a story. And I feel like a lot of what I do when I look at a historic cookbook, and I try to recreate a recipe, what I'm doing is trying to get in the shoes of those people, those women, especially the idea that somebody's great, 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 great grandmother made this recipe in her log cabin or whatever, you know, and trying to tell her story or whatever cookbook I'm looking at. It's it's not about me at that point. It's about telling someone else's story. And I think that sometimes a lot of those stories get lost in our this day of, like, you know, processed convenience foods. We forget.
Oh, yeah.
You know,
I love the idea of somebody's grandma or great grandma sitting somewhere with, like, a stove or a smoker, mm-hmm. and just cursing to the moon about things over and over again. And then when everyone shows up, it's just like this nice, sweet, uh-huh. like, look what I did for everyone. But, like,
yeah.
I said terrible things about you.
You have no idea have the no words idea that came out of my mouth.
And what I had, what I tried to not say. I enjoy that story. I would love to tell that story, actually. That'd be fun.
Right?
Where's Terrence McNally?
Let's do it. I'm down. All right. So all of that being said, Ian and I wanted to get together. And like I said before, we wanted to talk about acid. Acid is a vital component in cuisine. It's a vital component in cocktails. And, you know, Ian is just as nerdy as I am, which is awesome. So we have a lot to say, which means that, you know, if we end up running long, y'all get bored. I get it. But we're going to talk your ear off about acid. So I'm going to jump in first with a little bit of science. Don't turn us off just yet. I promise you, I'm going to make it super simple because I'm really not a scientist. But in cooking in particular, one of the main purposes of an acid, so lemon juice, vinegar, is to denature the proteins. So basically, when you marinate something in a lemon juice olive oil mixture, you're doing that because that process helps open up and break down the proteins on the outer layers of, you know, it's usually a meat product that you're marinating. And it allows the flavors in that marinade to penetrate into the meat. And then sometimes you can, you know, poke it with a knife and get those flavors in even further. Ceviche works great because fish has much more delicate proteins. And so the acids can penetrate all the way and basically cook the fish. When you're dealing with beef and chicken, it's usually just the outer layers. But it doesn't break down connective tissue. So marinades start your process if you're doing like a beef, and then you need to finish the process with a heat application. Whereas ceviche, you don't need the heat. The acid does all the work for you.
What about, you know, in that vein, tartare, like beef tartares? I mean, obviously tuna tartare would be very easy to accomplish.
Yes.
But how do we...
So tartare is not necessarily the same application in that you're not trying to cook the beef.
Uh-huh.
You are eating it raw. You do flavor it, but it is meant to be a raw product. And that came from, you know, the history of sort of traveling and not having access to fire.
What prepares the meat that makes it safe for consumption, I guess, is my...
That's a lot like sushi. In that you have to be very careful where you're getting the meat from.
Okay.
You have to know what the animal is.
So it's truly a raw experience.
Exactly. Ceviche, on the other hand, is cooked, but you still need to make sure that you're getting a good grade of fish. You don't want like additives and you know, toxic things in that fish. You don't usually want to use a fish that has a really high mercury content or anything like that, you know, as pure as possible. Just like you would for sushi. It doesn't necessarily always need to be like top sushi grade that you'd spend, you know, a whole paycheck on. But it should be decent quality in order to make it into that ceviche. But that is essentially why they say that ceviche is a cooking process. It's just different from a heat application cooking process. And you can do the same thing if you're like, if you've ever tried to like marinate fish at home before you cook it. Doesn't work quite as well because you do start to cook that fish and you can see can see the change that happens.
Well, that
doesn't mean it's not good. It's just,
I mean, the sour cocktail, we're going to talk about that a lot. It's really the same concept, adding that egg including liquor, which will disinfect, but that citrus acid or a vermouth or a wine-based product that is high in acid is going to cook that egg. And even though the egg itself doesn't become like a cooked egg as we know it to eat, it's still cooked.
Right.
And that's what they refer to it as.
Right. Because it's the idea of, I don't want to say breaking down the cellular structure, but it does, denaturing the protein is that cooking process. So it's changing the structure of the protein itself. And that's what takes place. And that it is vital in certain dishes and it's vital in certain cocktails. Obviously, you have to have that reaction happen in order for it to be the product that you want it to be. Acids can come into play in other forms of cooking where they are absolutely necessary and it's not just a flavor thing. So like acids in baking, for example, they react with an alkali, which is so okay. So real quick, more basic science, pH levels, which I'm sure everybody has heard about, you know, basic seventh grade science, seventh grade, maybe fifth grade. I don't know. Eighth grade? I don't remember. No. It's been a long time.
They swap them out, I think.
Right. So pH, the pH scale, the middle of the pH scale is 7. 7 is neutral. 7 is like your basic water that hasn't been had a lot of additives to it. Anything above 7 is considered basic or an alkali. So baking soda, for example, is an alkali. Anything below 7 is considered an acid. So when you, and the two react, and they don't always cancel each other out, they might have some other chemical reaction. So in baking, if you have, sometimes you need the acid and the alkali to react to each other in order to leaven your product. For example, during the Depression, they came up with it, what's known as, well, sometimes it's called wacky cake, sometimes it's called crazy cake. I've heard it called depression cake, but it's basically, it's got a million names depending on the era, right? Depression cake. Let's have some depression cake.
That's not, that's what I have. That's what I have like on a bad day.
A depression cake. Yeah. I need some cake.
I need some cake. But I want to eat a whole cake.
It was cake that was made without eggs, milk, or butter because those things were all rationed during the Depression and during the war, right? So people didn't always have access to those things. But you take this, your dry ingredients, and you add an acid that has the alkali in it, so it's got baking soda in it, but then you also add an acid like vinegar, and that leavens your cake. And it becomes, it's an actual cake. Like, I've made it into cupcakes, and people don't know the difference. And what's great about that, too, is then it's vegan. So you can serve it to your vegan friends and be like, look, here, I made you cake. And what, it still tastes good. It tastes like cake.
What's your choice
cake.
Of vinegar?
It depends. For me, it depends on the cake.
What was probably the most available vinegar at that time?
Probably just either, probably white, apple cider vinegar.
Apple cider vinegar.
Yeah, yeah. Because white vinegar even now is used more for
cleaning.
For cleaning process. Yeah. But apple cider vinegar is something that people could make at home if they needed to. Right.
I have a bunch of vinegar in my car. It's called all the bottles of wine I did.
You did, right? Exactly. I have made this crazy cake out of red wine vinegar. I've made it with balsamic vinegar because I like to make it chocolate. Both times comes out great.
Yeah.
So, I mean, that's in that particular recipe, you have to have that acid or the recipe doesn't turn out. It doesn't work. And in things like preserving, the acid, bringing the pH level down is important because the lower the pH level, the less the likelihood of bacteria getting into your product. So, for example, water bath canning, which is what I do at work a lot, everything has to be below, technically not just below 7, it has to be below 4, pH below 4. So I'm usually aiming for around 3.4. And I do that, and you'll see all kinds of historic recipes like this. When you're making jam, you add lemon juice. It's not for flavor. It's to bring the pH level down, just in case. If you're doing tomatoes and you don't cook them right before you can them, the tomatoes are so acidic that it will start to ferment and it will explode. So, and
I enjoy that.
I know this firsthand. If you're going to try canning and you want to do tomatoes, please cook them. Cook them first. Cook your sauce first. Just really cook it down. Add a little bit of sugar, carrots or something sugary to it to balance it, because otherwise your tomato sauce will explode in your cabinet. It's not pretty. It's not fun. But it happens. So in those instances, acid is not a flavor component. It is a necessary reaction that has to happen.
And if I may include to that,
mm-hmm.
citric acid, if you were just to go to the store, buy citric acid,
right.
and to taste it, it would taste like a tart lemon.
Yes.
More than it would a lime or a grapefruit. It would have a very distinct lemony flavor to our tongue. That's how we would process it
mm-hmm.
mentally. So choosing lemon juice is interesting because it's like the most.
Right. Well, I think as far as preserving goes, you choose lemon juice because it is the one that's going to have the least adverse flavor reaction.
Right.
Right.
Because it's the most citric acid right. flavor. It's not like limes are so vegetative. Oranges yeah. are useless.
Right.
In that
application, yeah. absolutely. And yeah. you don't want to put, you're not going to put vinegar in your jam. You're not going to do it. I'm not going to do it because that flavor is going to read in yeah. the jam. And that's not something that you want. Now, obviously, when you're pickling, you're using vinegar. But the lemon is usually the flavor of choice. I have done lime before. I'll do lime juice in a pinch. Or I'll do it if I want that flavor mm-hmm. specifically.
Yeah.
I've done it with things like strawberries. Strawberry lime jam is really good.
Yeah.
Strawberry tequila lime jam is even better.
Nice.
I haven't done that one at the shop in a while, but maybe next year. So that the citrus acid that we're talking about is usually people see it on something or in a recipe and they get a little thrown off. They get even more thrown off if it's a vinegar. So what I'm saying is that oftentimes it is not a flavor profile that you're actually going to read. Sometimes it is. Obviously, you know, you want balsamic glazed carrots or something like that. That's a flavor that you're looking for. But oftentimes if you're seeing it in a recipe, especially if you're baking, people get really thrown off by, you know, novice bakers like, well, I have to put vinegar in this? That's not going to taste good. It's like putting salt in your dessert. People get a little thrown off. But there is, here to tell you, there's a reason for it. And it's important, and don't skip it. So... As far as cocktails go, is it the same kind of thing? Is it sometimes it's because of the flavor profile and sometimes it's because it's a necessary reaction? Is it both?
I think it's definitely both. You know, I just mentioned how shaking a cocktail with an egg white.
Yeah.
To do that, you would dry shake it and then you would wet shake it. You would shake it with ice.
Mm-hmm.
And a dry shake is doing a couple things, one of which is taking that egg and cooking it, disinfecting it, making it safe to consume.
Mm-hmm.
It's also aerating and allowing that egg to meringue a little bit.
Right, get frothy.
Yeah, so
right.
that's another function of that.
Mm-hmm.
But in cocktails, I would say that where the big difference is that you're looking for balance of flavor above all else.
Mm-hmm.
Because for the most part, what we're consuming in a cocktail is good to go.
Right.
There doesn't really need to be any process other than emulsifying those liquids together, getting those flavors together.
Right, right.
That's the big thing, which is being done with shaking, stirring, and water mm-hmm. for the most part. You're not really looking for that acid to do a whole lot for the drink as a function.
Okay.
Cocktails are... Food is necessary.
Right.
Cocktails are... At this point in our lives and history, is just a luxury, and one that I enjoy making for people and enjoying. But it's not necessary. You know, you're not talking about like in ceviche where the acid comes to play as a means of cooking.
A necessary component.
As a
right.
necessary component, because a lot of what's going into ceviche most certainly needs to be cooked.
Right. Right.
Especially with what they were, where you know, the history of what ceviche is and where it was, what part of the world it came from and how they were consuming it. They probably absolutely had to
yes.
disinfect that.
Yeah.
So no, not quite the same. It's okay. a lot more enjoyable and fun.
Awesome.
It's just a cool thing to do.
It's a cool thing to do that tastes good.
But one other reason that it's there is if you look at your taste palate, if you look at the tongue and you see a diagram of where we experience taste on our tongue, the tart, the sour portion of our tongue just lights up.
Right.
It's like the whole thing.
Right.
So that's a huge place. I guess that's where we experience a lot of flavor.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a great anchor, I
yeah.
would say, to flavor. You're going to see that a cocktail really is a balance of spirit, sweet, and sour or bitter.
Okay.
So it's three components. Is it going to be, and that third component being sour or bitter, was it going to be sour or bitter? Or
right.
both?
Okay.
Yeah.
Awesome. Awesome. I do have a side note, which is kind of interesting that I discovered in some of my nerdy research, is that when you use an acid, when you use an acid. Thanks for that.
Anytime. I'm here for you.
you use an acid to open the cell walls to denature the proteins of a meat product, right? When you want to do the same thing for a vegetable product, you don't always use an acid. Sometimes you need the opposite, which I found really fascinating. So like the Aztec tradition of, am I going to say this right? Nixtamalization. That might not be how it's actually said, but basically it's the idea of taking the dried corn and denaturing its protein so that it can be turned into a raw dough, right? So this is what tortillas traditionally came from. That is done with a base, with an alkali, not an acid.
Are corns quite, is that quite acidic? I actually don't know.
Corn is not, but the lye that they would apply to it, or that lye is what's used now. It used to be, they used to bury the corn in ash. So burnt, like wood ash, basically, because that's a very alkali substance. Mm-hmm. And that denatures the protein of the corn and softens it in order to be ground into a dough.
That would be the smokiest tortilla.
I think it would be kind of awesome.
It'd be really interesting.
I wonder if Rick Bayless has ever actually made it that way, because I would love to taste that. I'd love to find out. I mean, he's kind of...
That's a good question.
Yeah, you know what? I might ask him.
Rick?
Hey, Rick, if you're out there... hit us up, email me, go to hearthandsoulblog.com and shoot me a note. And I'd love to know if you've ever done that, because I think that would be really good. Anyway, that was a side note tangent. So in our discussion the other day, we got into talking about historic cookbooks, historic reproductions and antique cookbooks and that kind of thing. And we had a really interesting discussion about the difference between how they used to write cookbooks versus, what would you call it, cocktail books? And how they write them now.
Recipe books, I guess.
Recipe books.
Yeah, because when we were in our discussion, I had said, I think I had referenced a lack of cocktail books, which like a quick Amazon search would very... swiftly knock me in the groin with a falsehood. But what I really meant when I was talking to you about that was a lack of books with great advice. Like you get, there's just a portion of American history, unfortunately, that knocked out a lot of our historical understanding of liquor and cocktails in our own country, which is so funny because America, this is one of the few areas in the world where America truly is not only the innovator, but in its conception and like the culture of cocktails as we kind of know it today, it's like resurgence of craft cocktails, for instance.
Right.
It's really American cocktailing that was leading the world in how it was done.
Right.
And we talked about that, like with the Pisco Sour.
With the Pisco Sour, yeah.
Yeah. Jerry Thomas is maybe the first known author of a book on cocktailing in the art of cocktail.
Okay.
His book, it was written in 1876, but again.
18-something.
It was the late 1800s. He published a couple, he did a couple edits and released those as well. And he himself did it. And then Prohibition kind of came after all of that. And all of those people in the States went away.
Right.
And before that, they had also been traveling. But they now all, if they were a bartender and a cocktail artist or a mixologist, however you want, whatever word you want to use, no one's 100% on that one either.
Mm-hmm.
But they all went to England and France and South America and Central America and into places where they could practice their craft and not be doing something that was then illegal.
Right. Yeah. Right. Okay.
Yeah. So a lot of those books are really interesting. And if you look at Jerry Thomas's recipes, they are wackadoo because of the way spirits are made at that time.
Okay.
You know, we have just better technology is really what it comes down to.
Right.
And so we can make much cleaner spirits for consumption. So he was adding way more sugar and way more other ingredients to balance out the flavor of the alcohol, because the flavor of the alcohol could have been very strident, very aggressive on the palate,
right?
Very ethanol, methanol-y at times.
This actually makes a lot of sense, because I'm thinking about some of my I have a whole collection for our listeners of historic, most of them reproductions, cookbooks. I don't actually follow recipes often, but I do use these as sort of guides and teaching methods to just learn about basically where we came from. But the more you're talking about this, the more I'm realizing that a lot of those cookbooks have cocktail recipes in them. So, and I've always marveled at just how much sugar they put in them. For example, I have a Colonial.
Right.
Colonial Williamsburg has a reproduction of a cookbook that's basically a collection of recipes from people that would have lived there during the colonial era, right? And there's an entire section on punches and beverages.
Right.
And a lot of them are very, very sweet, very thick, creamy type things. Frothy, floofy, whatever. Lots of heavy cream is used. Lots of sugar is used. But I wonder if the lack of maybe separate recipe books for cocktails is because those were put in these other books that I almost don't want to call them cookbooks because they were sort of like housewife guides, if you will.
Right.
So these were books that had like, this is how you cook meals. These are the cocktails that your husband will like. These are cleaning tips. This is how you polish your silver. Like, those were all in one book. It was like a housewife's companion.
Right.
So I'm wondering, and those date all the way, you know, back to like the 1600s.
That is, I have no answer to that. I have nothing to say to that other than very possibly.
Right. It just now occurred to me.
Yeah. I mean, another thing too about the cookbooks and what getting into what we have today, or rather the cocktail book and the recipe books around cocktails,
mm-hmm.
what we have today is we do have a flooded market of like, books for your dad to know how to make a Manhattan out mm-hmm. of like bullshit he has in his cabinet. And those too are kind of weird. There's this, I can't remember what it's called, but it's like it was made in the 90s or maybe the 80s, but I think it was mostly in the 90s. And it's like a long, slender thing. It's this big, tall, like bartender's compendium or manual or something like that. You know what I'm talking about?
Yeah,
it's like laminated.
Yeah.
Because they're like, this is going to be behind a bar, so we should laminate it.
Yeah, I think I had one.
Oh, I'm sure everyone did.
Yeah.
Especially back then. And that is really around how Americans embraced liquor after Prohibition.
Okay.
And a lot of our spirits are aged and were aged back then. I mean,
mm-hmm.
if you look at the history of American whiskey, specifically, there's just those, all of it was aged at a very high level, you know. So you had things in rickhouses for 5, 10, 12, 20 years because that was desirable.
Mm-hmm.
Then Prohibition comes around. And while they were still making whiskey in particular during Prohibition, but other spirits as well during Prohibition, but for medicinal use.
Right.
And so, it was a small quantity. And they had enough. You know, Prohibition was short, like 13 years?
It was like 13 years.
Yeah. It was super short. We looked at that and I was like,
yeah, it was really
holy mother,
short and then
so
overlapped with the Great Depression.
Yeah, exactly.
How much would that suck, though? Like, let's just as an aside, like, the stock market crashes in 1929 and everybody loses everything and everybody's dirt fucking poor. And for like 4 years, you can't have alcohol. It's illegal. Like, it's the most depressing time of the country, literally, and you can't have a drink. That just sucks. Like,
that does just suck.
That just sucks. I'm really glad that let's knock on some wood that won't happen, but I'm really glad that I didn't have to live through that.
No, that would really suck. But
anyway,
going back to aging, age takes time, and there's really no substitute for time when you're talking about aging.
Right.
There are plenty of people with techniques. There's the Jefferson whiskey that they age in a boat, and then the water is moving the liquid in the barrels and it's getting more barrel coverage, and that's supposed to age it faster. And if you use a smaller barrel, volume to surface area is your friend in that case. And these are all true. It's true. That
right.
will help, but it's still, it really isn't a substitute for time.
Right.
At the end of the day, maturation of a spirit is sitting in a barrel,
mm-hmm.
probably oak, and allowing the barrel to become more porous and less porous, bringing in the liquid and shooting back the liquid back out mm-hmm. Into the barrel.
Okay.
You really can't have a substitute for that.
Right.
So Americans weren't getting, prohibition ends and they can have beer, and wine is a lot easier to produce. And sure, vodka and gin are quick to produce, but mm-hmm. you don't really have the spirits of choice, which were brandies and whiskeys,
right,
in America at that time,
because they weren't being made in
prior
in,
to prohibition.
Right
So our culture around drinking was kind of bastardized. It was not, it wasn't focused, there was nothing keeping it together. It was far more regulated, which was a good thing, because regulation probably would have kept prohibition from happening altogether. But you just don't have a drinking culture. So you get into the 50s and you have people taking the martini and turning it into cold vodka in a glass that looked at vermouth or whatever, whatever bullshit rules.
Wave the vermouth bottle over the top of the,
And you know who, it's always a guy in cargo shorts who's over the age of 45 who's like telling you how to make a good martini.
Years ago when I was a bartender, and I use that term very loosely because I was nowhere near the level that you are, but I actually had a guy tell me that, you know, make it super dry. Okay. Like I mean, just wave the vermouth bottle over the top of the glass. Don't even pour it. So it's you like, want cold vodka is
so you
what
want
you
cold
want.
Vodka and an olive. I love olives too.
Right. That is that's a beverage?
But okay. That's why. So like you get to the 90s and you have this book, and it's because we were both entering the age of mass consumerism
mm-hmm.
and changing how we create products,
mm-hmm.
not just spirits, but just products in general, and
right.
how we were expediting our consumption. We were no longer willing to wait for what we were creating.
Right.
And so you have a lot of cocktail books, especially in those like 80s, 90s era where it's there's no technique to them or knowledge to them. It's mm-hmm. just combining these things together to create cold liquid that has any number of spirits in it.
Interesting.
Yeah.
It says a lot about those of you out there who peruse Pinterest the way that I do, because most of what comes up on my Pinterest feed is, you know, food related or whatnot. I often see these pins that are random beverages with weird names, and it's always, I always look at the list and think, really? Like, really though? Like, that's all gonna go together in one glass and you're gonna drink that? That seems super random to me. And it doesn't seem to have like a method to its madness, if you will.
No, and like what we call punch today.
Oh, that's a whole different, I know.
We could do another like day on that one. But punch is important for what? For cocktailing and the sour, you know, mm-hmm. I really came prepared to talk about the sour.
Yeah.
Because that's obviously, everyone can kind of immediately grasp like an acid in a cocktail. Oh, sour.
Oh, sour, yeah.
But that really comes from a punch, which was spirit, sugar, citrus peel,
mm-hmm.
citrus juice and citrus peel.
Right.
Tea and spices.
Right.
And if you think of a classic whiskey sour or, you know, something I came prepared to make us all, the Pisco Sour.
Mm-hmm.
Pisco Sour is Pisco, spirit, sugar, lime juice, citrus,
mm-hmm.
and bitters.
Right.
And what are bitters but spices?
Spice
that have
reduced.
Been
yeah.
Reduced.
Reduced and
like
extracted. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, that makes sense. I do, some of you know this, I do a sort of Dickensian Christmas party every year at my house. And, I always make, and this was done after lots of research because all the food is related to either Charles Dickens or the book A Christmas Carol or that very specific time period. And what I often serve is a punch called a smoking bishop, which is essentially a red wine punch, but heavily fortified with spirits, sugar, and oranges.
Yeah.
Oranges studded with cloves. So that's the spice. It doesn't actually have a tea in it, but because it's hot. It's served hot. So all the oranges with the cloves have steeped in that, you know.
Well, and that basically is a punch. And the punch that I'm referring to when I say like with a tea, I'm referring to what British colonists found in India.
Right.
And they said, mine.
Right.
That's mine now.
As
Merry
they did
Christmas.
With so many things.
Yeah. But that's true. And that's really where it came over. And that is probably as best as all the books that I've read can deduce, the origin of cocktailing as we know it.
Right. Okay.
People have been getting drunk for a long time.
Right.
You can make a still out of a coconut. If you really have
The gumption.
Yeah. And a hammer. Don't forget the hammer.
So we have some time, I think. Yes. Why don't we talk a little bit more about the sour and the various applications of, because we had talked about citrus fruits and why you use certain citrus in certain applications.
Yeah. Mostly with spirits.
Mostly with spirits.
Or rather, which citrus you use with what kind of spirit.
Right. So talk a little bit about that.
All right. Well,
go to town, man.
Go to town? That is a daunting task.
I'll cut you off.
Okay. So spirits are either aged or not. They are
right.
They are clear or they are not.
Gotcha.
Then there's more to that as well. There's more aging. There's less aging. There's also other ways to get flavor. There's something called a neutral spirit. When we're talking about neutral spirit, we're talking about vodka as the most recognizable consumer good.
Mm-hmm.
And they all have their own element. And, you know, I'll be 100% honest. I went up to Angela and I said, I want to do this.
Yeah, that's why I'm letting him, just so you all know, I'm just going to let him go on this because this particular episode was his idea. So, and I'm fascinated to hear what you have to say because like I said, my bartending skills were okay, but not.
I would also like to say one thing. I'm currently not a bartender. I do not work behind a bar. I think what those people do is incredible work, hard work, and it balances the culinary to the hospitality.
Mm-hmm.
And I have immense respect for them. So I would never call myself a bartender.
That's fair. Yeah. That's fair.
Yeah, it's just not, it just wouldn't be fair to all those people that I worked with who are currently working.
Right.
Right now.
And that's
probably
also
juicing a lemon.
Why I use that term very loosely. I did was stand behind a bar and pour shit in glasses.
Hell, I think that's one hell of a bartender because, not all bartenders make cocktails, but all bartenders serve drinks.
True.
And that is hard work on your feet, making people smile and cutting people off. It's its own art form in and of itself. And so I think that's important. It's an important distinction because I don't want to make anyone feel
right.
Either slighted or left out. And I especially don't want to discredit anyone's hard work.
Right. Well, and I do think, honestly, just to like lay it out there, and yeah, okay, I work in food service, so maybe this is a little bit biased, but I really feel strongly that every single job that is in the food service industry, all those people, they demand your respect. Like,
oh, yeah.
You know, like if I go out to a restaurant, I'm going to tip at least 30-35% because I just feel so strongly that these people are putting their heart into their craft for the most part, you know.
It's hard.
And if your craft is standing behind a bar and pouring beer, you know what? That's awesome. And
making a living. That's another thing too.
Yeah.
So I don't want to say I do have something else to say about that. God damn it. But I'm going to focus on the task at hand. That's the goal. When you're talking about flavor, is really kind of what attracted me to do this, to approach Angela, to even start this conversation at all, mm-hmm. was I am currently in a world where I am immersed in flavor constantly, and not anything I can put on my palate can I just sit there and enjoy it. I have to dissect it.
Analyze.
Yeah, and it's kind mm-hmm. of like, it's kind of like those like first 3 years in music when we were all just insufferable.
Yes.
About music, just the worst to talk to about music because we're constantly thinking about it and we're, you know, that's not a bad thing per se. It's just rather knowing how to like process it.
Mm-hmm.
So this felt like a healthy way in which to process all of that.
Yeah.
So when you're looking at vodka, for instance,
mm-hmm.
it's supposed to be neutral and people think that a good vodka tastes like nothing, which is almost true. You do want to distill the liquid to a very high proof. That's essentially what's making it neutral. When you're distilling, you can distill to various levels of ABV, alcohol by volume.
Mm-hmm.
And in doing so, you will have more or less flavor congeners based on what you're doing.
Okay.
So whiskey is obviously going to have more than vodka.
Right.
More than gin.
Right.
More than some tequilas, even.
Mm-hmm. You know. Definitely, yeah.
Just
depending.
Depending, yeah. There are rules. I'm not going to get into what those rules are. We only have so much time.
You know, we can always have another podcast.
We could.
A later date, we could have another podcast just about just spirits. Just not about the acidic component, but just about spirits.
Right.
That's a possibility. Just so you know. I'm just putting that out there.
But in that vein, with like talking about spirits to acid, when you're using acids to create either a sour, or if you're going to make a Manhattan, which is
my favorite.
It's delicious. It's you know, whiskey to vermouth, and vermouth is a wine. Wine is acidic.
Yes.
Or vermouth was a wine, is a wine, however you want to. I don't. I'm nervous about the comments, possibly. But. But you're going to use a red vermouth.
Yes.
With a whiskey, that makes flavor sense. And so when you're talking about lemons versus limes versus orange versus grapefruit,
and
so on and so forth, lime is a little bit more acidic than lemon, although lemon and lime are very close.
Right.
So you can almost use it to a one-to-one. A lime is going to, a typical table lime, just what you would get at the grocery store, what you would see behind a bar, is going to yield juice for roughly one cocktail. A Eureka lemon is going to yield juice for roughly three cocktails.
Okay.
That's the kind of the biggest difference. And then you have, of course, the flavor component of
that. Right, right.
Limes, like I said, are very herbaceous and vegetative and green. Green like grasses can be almost sometimes. And lemons are a little bit brighter. They're a little bit more floral as opposed to like bitter flower, which you get out of the lime.
Mm-hmm.
Those two things we're going to pair very differently. This is a rule of thumb. This is not a hard and fast rule. Don't take my word for it. If you like to do something at home that is great, then keep doing it. But lime is going to go great with vodka and gin, these unaged spirits, white rum, white blanco tequila, these kinds of things. To maybe Calvados.
Okay.
Because it's not as aged, but then you're looking at aged. And I think lemon, with that kind of bright, sweeter, less green, less herbaceous and vegetative quality, is going to go really great with these aged spirits.
That's really interesting because as far as breaking the rules, right? In Venezuela, at least my family, Venezuela produces a lot of really, what I consider really high quality aged rum.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not clear. It's dark.
Yeah.
It's brown. And we drink that with lime, not lemon. Because in South America, there really aren't lemons. People just know limes. Like, there's not really a word for
lemon.
It's lime. So everything is lime.
Yeah.
But when we drink these particular rums, we drink them straight.
Yeah.
Neat. With a lime wedge on the side.
Sometimes, I hate to do this. I'm going to do something that I hate to do.
Uh-oh.
Sometimes, when you see the label dark rum, it is a white rum that has been colored and flavored.
Yes, that I understand.
Yeah.
I will say that these particular rums I'm talking about, they don't do that.
And but on the flip side of that coin, sometimes you see a rum that is clear that was aged and filtered. So the color was then removed, not necessarily because they wanted the color removed, they wanted to filter it.
Okay.
And in doing so, the color was then removed.
Interesting.
Yeah.
So would they still label that as aged?
No, not necessarily. There is no requirement by law in the United States to create an age statement.
Huh.
However, there are certain spirits that have certain rules. So if you see certain kinds of labels, like cognac has its own labels, the VS, the VSOP, the XO, the Napoleon. Mm-hmm. Then with bourbon in particular, if we're going to just to touch on that.
Yeah.
Bourbon actually has no age requirement. It has
really,
a,
I didn't
it must
know that.
Be aged in a barrel.
Okay.
That does not preclude any time. Now, if you want to be called a straight bourbon, that is a 2-year plus aging process. And if you wanted to be bottled and bond to be a bonded barrel or nowadays it's not necessarily the same thing, but to have that kind of that moniker on your bottle would imply that it was aged to a certain level. But those are separate from the delineation of bourbon.
Okay. Interesting.
Yeah.
So what about, we talked about lemons and limes and the, you know, loose rule, I'll say. Because really, I'm just going to put this out there. Whatever you do and whatever you like is fine. It's all fine. Like, in my opinion, there are these guidelines to help you enjoy things in the best way possible.
Oh, people ask me all the time, how do I drink this? Because I show spirits. I say, here, try this. Enjoy it. And I talk about the spirit raw, essentially. Yeah. How do I drink this? And I'm like, I just don't get drunk and drive. And I'm dandy.
Drink it
as a
however
fly.
You
like,
want. Yeah.
I don't worry about that so much.
Right.
If you're enjoying it, enjoy it.
Yeah. I think there's too much of this, like, it's a little bit like how opera is seen as being so, like, unreachable. Like, it's not for common people and it's not accessible. Right. I feel like cuisine in a general sense is becoming a lot like that. Like, it's inaccessible and people are afraid of it. People are afraid of new things. They're afraid of, they're going to do it wrong.
Right.
So putting that out, putting all of these rules aside, drink it how you want.
Yeah.
Right. At the end of the day.
Yeah.
I always recommend, it's the same with food. I recommend people, oh, you've never had this particular vegetable before. You know what? Just cut off a piece and just taste it on its own, just by itself.
Enjoy.
Obviously, unless it's inedible raw, but you know what I mean, like, get that flavor first and then do whatever you want with it. It's up to you. Like, however you enjoy those spirits, enjoy them.
Mm-hmm.
Right. That being said, do you have any, like, sort of loose rules about, say, orange or grapefruit? Like, are those things that are used as, I know they're not used as often,
they're not used as often, you know, the most common would definitely be lemon, I would say. It's probably the most common. Lime is very commonly used. It's in a lot of classic cocktails.
Mm-hmm.
Orange is not great to have behind a bar. When you, this is going to get into like the method of juicing, which I don't think we need to touch on. I think more importantly, it's about flavor.
Mm-hmm.
And lemon and lime is so much more acidic. So it's going to light up that part of your palate so much more in a cocktail.
Mm-hmm.
And you're going to balance to the sugar, which is balancing to the spirit.
Right.
It's kind of, is the what are you going to call that? The lineup of
formula?
Sure. Formula. Sure. Yeah. How, you know, spirit is there, so you need sugar. Sugar is there, so you need bitter or sour.
Mm-hmm.
Orange doesn't have as high of a pH, and thus it doesn't really do much other than provide a flavor. And then when you're talking about behind the bar itself, you know, I'm not going to knock you for having a mimosa, but that's probably pasteurized orange juice. And for the home, nothing wrong with pasteurized orange juice, but it can negatively affect the flavor of your drink.
Right.
It can be more bitter, or it can be less sweet, or it can be less flavorful because it's pasteurized.
Mm-hmm.
When you juice something, there's a lot of schools of thought on how to use citrus juice behind a bar or in a cocktail. Some people think the best method would be to hand press it immediately. So you hand press into it. And that is because that elbow press, which we've all seen, is that kind of that bulb with the hinge.
Yeah.
It's going to press down on the citrus, but it's also going to press the zest and the pith. And you're going to get elements from the natural oils from the zest. And you're going to get some bitterness from the pith. It's going to be kind of a whole experience. And that's one way to extract as much flavor into the juice as possible.
Mm-hmm.
There are other methods to do that. There are other kind of presses and other juicers.
Yeah.
That are good. But the one thing that everyone agrees on is that you have about, some people say like 8 hours on lemon juice, less on lime juice, and about an hour and a half, 2 hours on orange juice.
Really?
You juice that orange, and it's not, like, if you juice an orange and 4 hours later you have a glass of orange juice, it's not
going to hurt you.
Yeah, you're not going to go to anaphylactic shock. It's just,
right.
It's just not, it's going to be maybe bitter. It's going to be less flavorful. It's just going to decay in a way that's not good. The other thing that people are kind of talking about too is like a pressed lemon, an immediately pressed lemon, you're going to get all those flavors. But some people would even say that that juice needs to sit for an hour or so.
Hmm.
To allow some of those sugars and acids to break down.
Interesting. Okay.
As like a peak flavor.
Right. So, yeah. So in cooking, when you're using citrus for a flavor component and not as an, you know, not for its chemical reaction, right? We often will zest, you know, with like a microplane.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Grater kind of thing. Some people, you know, you got a box grater that works too. But if you say a recipe calls for the juice and the zest, they're having you do that separate because they want those oils, like you just talked about. They mm-hmm. want the oils that come in the zest. What we don't want in cooking is the pith part, the white
bitter
part.
Yeah.
Because that's bitter, right? And that, depending on what you're cooking, that can be a flavor that you don't want
right.
in that. You may want it in a cocktail, but you don't want it in like your kale salad, for example, or in your lemon meringue pie.
Right. Although I would argue that you would do want it. You do want a full fruit experience in like a vinaigrette that you create.
Yes.
So pressing would be a better option.
Yes, that I would. Definitely. Although I generally make vinaigrettes with vinegar, but if I'm going to add a citrus
yeah.
to it,
if you're gonna do
that
like
makes much more sense.
Yeah. I would argue that you do want that.
Right.
And it depends on, again, what you're making. And since what you're making can be consumed over a greater period of time
mm-hmm.
or the experience typically, you know, in food, it's just a different,
right,
consumptive experience. When you're drinking, it's still faster.
Yeah,
even the slowest of drinkers.
It's a more immediate thing. You're going to craft yeah. a cocktail, and then somebody's going to drink it.
Right.
Whereas sometimes I'm going to create a salad, and somebody's not going to buy it right away. It's going to get purchased in a few hours, or it's even going to get purchased tomorrow.
Mm-hmm.
And the vinaigrette that goes with that salad is going to sit for a few days.
Yeah. And also, if you make a vinaigrette at home, if we're talking about home use, because that's mm-hmm. really, you know, if I have any advice to give on cocktailing, it's definitely for home use. Definitely
yeah.
not for when you're making that for home use, you can have that in your fridge for a while.
Oh yeah.
If you're going to make something that has lemon zest and juice in it, or citrus zest and juice in it,
mm-hmm.
and you could still store that.
Yeah.
But to have the pith in there would make that bitter element only come out even more.
Right, right.
And that would be bad.
And that would be bad, which is why, like, for example, your lemon meringue yeah. pie, you're going to zest that entire lemon on a microplane grater, and then you're going to juice it in, like, you know, the
hand juicer?
In the hand juicer.
Yeah.
So that pith and the rest of that skin is completely separate from what you're putting in your product.
Yeah.
So you're only getting the juice, and you're only getting the yellow part of the zest.
Mm-hmm.
So where all those oils are. At least that's how I do it. I don't know how other people do it, but, you know, I make a pretty good lemon meringue pie.
I believe that.
So I think that we're pretty close to time. So was there anything else that you wanted to enlighten us on? Sir Ian, can I call you that?
Why not?
Is Ian McKellen going to get breathed down my neck?
No. Not at
Sir
all.
Sir Ian.
He and I are good friends. Come at me. I think what I really want to touch on is that if you're looking to experience cocktails in your home and you're looking to buy spirits and make drinks, the best thing that you can do is to create a sour cocktail, which is one of the most basic cocktails to create. And it's just a really fun way to discover a balance of flavor. Because at the end of the day, with food and beverage, be it beer, wine, spirits, or otherwise, mm-hmm. we're just looking to create a flavorful experience. And to tangent a little bit in the same vein, when you're eating that big juicy steak, and that steak has all those, it was cooked, those mm-hmm. juices are just like kind of coating your mouth,
mm-hmm.
and you have a sip of a beautiful dry Cabernet. The reason that you pair those two things is because it's very dry.
Yes.
And it gives you a dry sensation in your mouth. And then when you take another bite of that big juicy steak, it's a full experience.
Right, right.
And cocktailing, and the sour in particular, is a great way to kind of see a microverse of that, where mm-hmm. you don't have to worry about cooking a great salmon and having a Chardonnay mm-hmm. to really see how those flavors can come together. You can start to see how flavors join together in this 3 to 4 ounce beverage that you created, and it can be just as satisfying.
as that steak
yeah. or a flavor experience.
Right.
So if anything, if I have to add, is that, it's that I really just wanted this to be a place where people could maybe think about what they're doing and explore. And instead of ordering a beer or an old fashioned at a bar, they might explore the cocktail menu mm-hmm. and just look at all the cool things that people are doing, because there is a stigma to cocktail bars, to fine dining, that it is out of reach, especially for a lot of people that we know within our own musical community.
Yeah.
Which, yeah. you know, this is not necessarily a podcast about music or that, but it is kind of, here we are.
Right.
And it's
right.
it's for that reason that we're connected.
Right. And to be honest, that's going to probably be our immediate audience anyway. Like,
totally.
The people who listen to this podcast when it launches.
I want those people to know that dining is accessible. It is something that you can spend money on, and there is absolutely nothing wrong with treating yourself to a fantastic night of food and drink.
Absolutely.
You know, you said that you were talking about how people do think about the stigmatism around price of dining or the price of a fancy cocktail.
Mm-hmm.
Honestly, if you spend $10 on a great cocktail and you really loved it, was that really the worst thing in the world?
Not at all.
It's not. It wasn't. It was pretty. It was, dare I say, pretty excellent.
Mm-hmm.
But let's go back to Longman and Eagle. Back in the mid-2000s, Longman and Eagle comes on the scene and they get a Michelin star.
Mm-hmm.
They were one of the first restaurants to get a Michelin star that wasn't a white tablecloth or a gastro pub experience. They were mm-hmm. they were truly this casual dining experience that was for people of the time.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, if you go to Longman and Eagle, you save up. It's not cheap.
Yeah.
But it's not an environment that is prohibitive. It is not a place where you aren't welcome. And that's kind mm-hmm. of what I wanted it to do, is encourage people to experiment for themselves, but also to just get out and try new things.
Right.
Well, we didn't talk about any spirits, which is kind of a bummer. But
it can be a whole nother podcast.
It can be another thing. But I do. I just want people to know that with food, you can create all these kinds of things.
Mm-hmm.
And if you want to see how those flavors play immediately, you can create a drink. It doesn't have to be alcoholic even.
Right.
It can be a combination of great cool things. Yeah.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I think at the end of the day, whether it's, you know, about acids or about dining experiences or about life in general, it's all about balance. We bring acid into play to balance out what we're cooking, what we're drinking. You take yourself out for a nice meal because it's about balance. You know, you don't have to eat ramen your entire life. Like, you save up and you take yourself out.
But if
out.
You do go to a great ramen place, because it's really great.
Go to a real ramen place.
Go to a real ramen place.
Oh my God. Yes.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Or, you know, treat yourself to just, you know, there are a million and one amazing food establishments in this city of Chicago. Like, so many places that I haven't even been to yet, and I shame myself for it on the regular, because as a foodie, I should have visited a lot more by now. But take yourself out. Go somewhere new. Try something new. Try a new cuisine that you've never tried before. If you've not had ramen, oh my gosh, please go try some ramen. Please go try some pho. Please go to a save
Have
up your
Ethiopian food.
Oh
and
my
don't
gosh.
Make any jokes about it. That's really mean.
It's really awful.
But have Ethiopian food. It's phenomenal.
Yeah, it's so good. The flavors are like mind blowing.
Talk about bitter. That bitter bread.
Yes.
That base, that whole thing.
That holds it all together.
Yeah. And that's the back of your tongue and then you have to include all those delicious foods to just make your palate light up.
Yep. There's a lot of experiences to be had. So at the end of the day, go have them. So I just have one last thing. Ian, I have this segment that I'm going to try and have be part of my regular podcast recording called What's in Your Pie Hole. So basically, I want to know, you know, we go through phases of what we're eating a lot of at one, you know, sometimes it's for a few days, sometimes it's for a few weeks, you know, like I think last time I was all about this dressing that I made, this garlic scape dressing. What is your thing right now that you're just like eating a ton of?
Right now,
it could be drinking too. In your case, if there's something drinking. You're really into right now,
I'm gonna do both.
Okay,
I'm gonna do both. I'm gonna do both. I've been drinking a lot of cognac recently. That's partly due to my job and partly because I found this cognac and I just loved it. And I went to work one day and I said, I think we should represent this. And we did. So I've been learning as much about it as I can. I've been drinking Camus cognac. It's a Bordery cognac. And cognac is made in the region of Cognac, but then there are different appellations there within.
Right.
And the Bordery is the smallest.
Okay.
And there are, of the cognac regions, Bordery is up there as one of the more desirable appellations.
Okay.
And it's just been a really unique experience. And also, as a history food nerd. It's probably the spirit that was most consumed in America and the colonies kind of immediately. Like the original Sazerac was a cognac Sazerac.
Fascinating.
Yeah, the Brandy Crusta, which is probably the precursor to the sidecar.
Okay.
Cognac based there as well. The Old Fashioned was probably cognac in most places, just because it was what was
available.
No, what was in vogue.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, it was available. Yes.
Yes.
But also, everyone loved it.
Awesome.
So that's what I've been drinking a lot of, and like doing a lot of different cognac cocktails. None of which I'm going to say because a lot of them are French and I just do not want to embarrass myself.
That's fair.
But for food, I've been making a lot of pasta and experimenting with, and I unfortunately don't make my own pasta. It's kind of an issue of space.
You know, that's okay. It's okay.
But I've been making a lot of pasta dishes and I've been trying to make as many pasta dishes without red sauce.
Awesome.
And not also without cream sauce.
Okay.
Just because those are like, I just, they're great.
Right.
Don't get me wrong. Give me some spaghetti and meatballs and I'm seven and happy.
Right.
But I just experimenting with like with different oil sauces I can make, with different meat toppings, with different vegetable toppings, just to kind of change it up a little bit. And
awesome.
I've also been experimenting with the level of salt in my pasta water.
Mm-hmm.
And I dare I say, am quite salty.
Mm-hmm. I believe that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I have a salty palate.
Yeah.
For sure.
I do too with certain things, but I'll put out there that I am, if people ever write in and ask for recipes, we're going to have a problem because I am a very intuitive cook. Mm-hmm. So I have been in this business a long time. I can figure out amounts, but I don't measure things. So, you know, like a palm full of salt is usually what goes in my pasta water, which is a lot.
It's about a quarter cup.
Yeah, it's about a quarter cup.
That's
and I have a small palm, but still, you know, and that's for a few servings, maybe, depending on how hungry I am.
Yeah.
But
I was the same way with cooking for the longest time.
Yeah.
And recently I've been very precise about my measurements. And it's not necessarily because I want to be very precise about how I cook.
Right.
But rather, I just want to know, I've been following recipes.
Mm-hmm.
And if I tweak them or not, I am very particular about how I include those ingredients.
Right.
Because I want to see the reaction.
Right. And that makes sense. And if I'm doing something in a method that I've never done before, then I will follow a recipe of sorts. For example, if I'm delving into the cuisine of a culture that I am not super familiar with. For example, I don't cook a lot of Asian food, mostly because I can't have soy, but I will find a recipe from a good source. Like, you know, if I want to make something Vietnamese, I'm going to find a Vietnamese person who wrote a recipe and I'm going to follow it to a T.
Yeah.
Before I fuck with it. But that being said, most of what I cook is not, there are not recipes. A few years ago, had to actually sit down and write down actual measurements for all the recipes that I created at work. And that was a task and a half, let me tell you. But it's great because now my assistant can just look it up on Google Docs and I can say, hey, can you make the green pesto for this week? Oh, yeah, I'm on it. And they've got the recipe there.
Right. Which is really, they're convenient.
They're convenient.
They're
I get it. I think I'm just more of an intuitive creator, if that makes sense. And so I have a hard time sometimes explaining my process.
Right. And with, like, you know, and going back to drinks, when I'm making them, could I make a drink freehand? Absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
Would I be as consistent each time?
Right.
I just wouldn't.
Right.
So if you're making drinks at home,
measure.
Absolutely measure, because you are gonna screw yourself. Also, you might need to that's how you know you can tweak. If you know that roughly 3/4 ounces lemon juice is like the perfect balance to 3/4 ounce simple and 2 ounces spirit for your sour, that's the general makeup. But it's just not quite sour enough, then you know that you need to maybe like dash some more on top.
Right.
Yeah.
You can tweak.
You can play. Totally tweak. But knowing your measurements is, I think it's really important. I think that's what they teach in schools, in culinary schools.
They do. I mean, I never actually finished culinary school, so that should be a caveat somewhere in this.
Yeah, right there.
There it is. There's my caveat. I never actually finished culinary
Just
school.
Just reference episode two.
Reference
every
episode
time
two.
Every time somebody says something about something.
My culinary school was run by a bunch of really old white men, and I sort of just couldn't do it. I couldn't handle it. So I learned on the job, you know, pretty much. I just learned, like I said, intuitive. That's how I do most things.
But you know, like so many cooks and bartenders do.
Right. It's just, you just kind of know. You kind of, you learn the things and you retain the things, and then you just kind of know them and they become part of who you are and part of what you do.
I don't really know a lot of certified mixologists.
I don't either.
Because why?
Right.
Because it's such a new thing that one's really sure what to do with it.
Right. Well, so what's in your pie hole has been pasta and cognac. That sounds like a freaking great meal to me.
It is. It is really nice, actually.
I've been big into pasta lately, too, but I can't have gluten, so I found this at Costco, actually. I found a quinoa-based pasta. It's a fusilli pasta, and it actually cooks up with a really nice, like, toothy bite to it.
Have you ever used the pasta water in your cooking?
Yes.
And does it have a similar effect?
And not quite as much, depending on what the gluten-free pasta is made out of. So,
God damn it. Pasta water is just so freaking
magical.
Useful. Yeah.
Now, if you're using a corn pasta, that water will have a lot of starch in it. So that can help you in what using that, right? But this one, not as much, because it's made of like quinoa and millet? And chia,
probably,
I think.
Millet. Millet's like couscous.
I think it's millet. Anyway, it's made out of a couple of different grains and seeds. But what I liked about it is the way it cooked up, and it still was like, it didn't fall apart. A lot of gluten-free pasta just falls apart. But I don't often put sauce on it because tomato sauce and I don't really get along. Sometime in the future, we'll talk about all of my food weirdness.
That'd be a great episode. Another little caveat, before you go off and make yourself some balsamic glazed pasta and a sour cocktail, have your Nexium. Get ready.
Well, that being said, I just want to put out there that there are some acids that actually, when are consumed, become base in the body. So, for example, lemon actually, even though it's an acidic fruit, citric acid, when you consume it, your body turns it into an alkali. So if, you know, there's a lot of weirdness out there about, like, having too much acid or not enough acid or whatever. Well, right,
because acid reflux is not a overconsumption of acid. It's an imbalance of acid.
Correct. Exactly. Yes. So
have your Nexium, because that will balance you out.
With your cognac and your... Drink some kombucha. It's great. But, so I've been eating a lot of pasta as well, and I usually do veggies and lots of garlic and olive oil and... Yeah. Then I cook a nice steak on the side.
Oh, yeah. Nick and I made Italian sausage, fusilli pasta, chard, mushroom, onion, garlic.
That's almost what I had last night, except I don't eat mushrooms.
Just drizzle a little bit of olive oil. Oh, one of the best things anyone can do for themselves in their own home kitchen, just like a weird little tangent, a piece of advice. I say tangent a lot. Can we just edit that out? A piece of advice. Get yourself... squeeze bottles.
Oh, yeah.
Like restaurant squeeze bottles, and fill it with lemon juice when you're cooking with lemon. Mm-hmm. Fill them with olive oil. Fill them with grapeseed oil. It is so flippin' easy.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just a great way to just do it real quick. You'd throw it in a pan.
Oh, yeah.
I have several in my kitchen.
I have them, too, although I must confess I don't actually use them because I learned how to use home... kitchen stuff in a restaurant setting, if that makes sense.
Oh yeah.
So like the trick of putting your fingers over the bottle opening in a bottle of olive oil will give you the same effect. So you can drizzle, right? So I learned how to do that a long time ago before I had access to squeeze bottles kind of thing. So, but I do have them for when I want to do intricate work or when I want to decorate cakes or something.
I also
like that.
Got an embossing labeler.
and it just looks good. So when you open my cabinet, it's quite fetching.
I have chalk labels, like chalkboard labels. Yeah. We are such nerds. We need like to hang out more.
It's a gun. It's like the greatest thing I ever gave myself. When Nick came home, like everything was labeled. I gave him a paper towel, and I even put paper towel on the... It was just like... It was such a... It was a treat for my childhood. I don't know if you guys... My dad was a photographer, so he labeled a lot of his stuff. Mm-hmm. Be it a bag, be it canisters of film.
Right.
He had an embossing labeler at home, and sometimes I would just like make labels as a kid. So like I got it, and I morphed into, again, 7-year-old Ian.
That's fine.
He loves labelers. He loves spaghetti and meatballs.
I like 7-year-old Ian. I mean, I like this Ian too, but...
7-year-old Ian was pretty cute.
I believe that.
Yeah. It was,
believe that.
It was after... Like, there was... It was awkward. And then...
And then cute.
Well, I definitely grew into adulthood well. But it was a big middle zone where it was just not working out.
I think that's most of us, to be honest.
It is.
Yeah,
I
think that's a thing.
I had very long arms.
That was never my problem. But on that note, I think we're going to close it out.
Okay.
It's been super fun.
This was super fun.
We'll definitely have to have another one all about just spirits, where I'll let you talk even more about just... spirits.
We should write a very detailed outline.
We will.
We should.
So stay tuned for sometime in the future. We will have spirit talk with Ian, and it'll be awesome. And that's it for today. So for more content, check us out at hearthandsoulblog.com, Hearth and Soul Blog on Instagram, and Hearth and Soul on Facebook. And if you like what you heard today, please go to iTunes, Google Play, Radio Public, and subscribe, rate, and please review us. It gets us out there to more people. Hearth and Soul, in case you didn't know, is produced by Scoppy Magazine. Head over to scoppymag.com to check out literally all the things, podcasts, articles, videos, and more to come. And thanks for listening.